I could not say, the dwarf told her. But one night some of Lord Tarly's soldiers visited the goose looking for him, and a few days later I heard another man boasting that he'd fooled a fool, and had the gold to prove it. He was drunk, and buying ale for everyone.
"Fooled a fool," she said. "What do you mean by that?"
I could not tell you. His name was Nimble Dick, though. That I do recall. The dwarf spread his hands. I fear that's all I can offer you, aside from a small man's prayers. True to her word, Brian bought him his bowl of hot crab stew, and some hot fresh bread and a cup of wine as well. As he ate it, standing by her side, she mulled what he had told her.
Could the imp have joined them?
If Tyrion Lannister were behind Sansa's disappearance and not Dontus Hollard, it stood to reason that they would need to flee across the narrow sea. When the little man was done with his bowl of stew, he finished what was left of hers as well.
"You should eat more," he said. "A woman big as you needs to keep her strength up. It's not far to Maidenpool, but the road is perilous these days."
"I know. It was on that very road that Sir Cleos Frey had died, and she and Sir Jamie had been taken by the bloody mummers. Jamie tried to kill me," she remembered, "though he was gone and weak, and his wrists were chained."
It had been a close thing, even so. But that was before Zolo hacked his hand off. Zolo and Rorge and Shagwell would have raped her 50 times if Sir Jamie had not told them she was worth her weight in sapphires.
"Milady, you look sad. Are you thinking of your sister?"
The dwarf patted her on the hand.
"The crone will light your way to her, never fear. The maiden will keep her safe."
"I pray that you're right."
"I am," he bowed. "But now I must be on my way. I've a long way yet to go to reach King's Landing."
"Do you have a horse, a mule?"
"Two mules," the little man laughed. "There they are, at the bottom of my legs. They get me where I want to go."
He bowed and waddled to the door, swaying with each step. She remained at the table after he had gone, lingering over a cup of watered wine. Brian did not oft drink wine, but once in a great while she found it helped to settle her belly.
"And where do I want to go?" she asked herself. "To Maidenpool? To look for a man named Nimble Dick in a place called the Stinking Goose?"
When last she had seen Maidenpool, the town had been a desolation. Its lord shut up inside his castle, its small folk dead or fled or hiding. She remembered burned houses and empty streets smashed and broken gates. Feral dogs had skulked along behind their horses, while swollen corpses floated like huge pale water lilies atop the spring-fed pool that gave the town its name.
"Jamie sang 'Three Maids and a Pool,' and laughed when I begged him to be quiet."
And Randall Tarly was at Maidenpool as well, another reason for her to avoid the town. She might do better to take ship for Gulltown or White Harbour.
"I could do both, though. Pay a call on the Stinking Goose and talk to this Nimble Dick, then find a ship at Maidenpool to take me farther north."
The common room had begun to empty. Brian tore a chunk of bread in half, listening to the talk at the other tables. Most of it concerned the death of Lord Tywin Lannister.
"Murdered by his own son, they say,"
a local man was saying, a cobbler by the look of him.
"That vile little dwarf."
"And the king is just a boy," said the oldest of the four scepters. "Who is to rule us till he comes of age?"
"Lord Tywin's brother," said a guardsman. "Or that Lord Tywell, might be, or the Kingslayer."
"Not him," declared the innkeeper. "Not that oathbreaker."
He spat into the fire. Brian let the bread fall from her hands and wiped the crumbs off on her breeches. She'd heard enough. That night she dreamed herself in Renly's tent again. All the candles were guttering out, and the cold was thick around her. Something was moving through green darkness. Something foul and horrible was hurtling towards her king. She wanted to protect him, but her limbs felt stiff and frozen, and it took more strength than she had just to lift her hand. And when the shadow sword sliced through the green steel gorget and the blood began to flow, she saw that the dying king was not Renly after all, but Jaime Lannister, and she had failed him. The captain's sister found her in the common room drinking a cup of milk and honey with three raw eggs mixed in.
"You did beautifully," she said,
when the woman showed her the freshly painted shield. It was more a picture than a proper coat of arms, and the sight of it took her back through the long years to the cool dark of her father's armory. She remembered how she'd run her fingertips across the cracked and fading paint, over the green leaves of the tree and along the path of the falling star. Brayne paid the captain's sister half again the sum they had agreed, and slung the shield across one shoulder when she left the inn, after buying some hard bread, cheese, and flour from the cook. She left the town by the north gate, riding slowly through the fields and farms where the worst of the fighting had been, where the wolves came down on Duskendale. Lord Ranley Tarley had commanded Joffrey's army, made up of Westermen and Stormlanders and knights from the Reach. Those men of his who had died here had been carried back inside the walls to rest in heroes' tombs beneath the Sept of Duskendale. The northern dead, far more numerous, were buried in a common grave beside the sea. Above the cairn that marked their resting place, the victors had raised a rough-hewn wooden marker. "Here lie the wolves," was all it said. Brian stopped beside it and said a silent prayer for them, and for Catelyn Stark and her son Rob and all the men who died with them as well. She remembered the night that Lady Catelyn had learned her sons were dead, the two young boys she'd left at Winterfell to keep them safe. Brayne had known that something was terribly amiss. She had asked her if there had been news of her sons. "I have no sons but Rob," Lady Catelyn had replied. She had sounded as if a knife were twisting her belly. Brayne had reached across the table to give her comfort, but she stopped before her fingers brushed the older woman's, for fear that she would flinch away. Lady Catelyn had turned over her hands to show Brayne the scars on her palms and fingers where a knife once bit deep into her flesh. Then she had begun to talk about her daughters.
"Sansa was a little lady," she had said, "always courteous and eager to please. She loved tales of knightly valour. She will grow into a woman far more beautiful than I. You can see that. I would often brush her hair myself. She had auburn hair, thick and soft. The red in it would shine like copper in the light of the torches."
She had spoken of Arya, too, her younger daughter, but Arya was lost, most likely dead by now.
"Sansa, though." "I will find her, my lady," Brian swore to Lady Catelyn's restless shade. "I will never stop looking. I will give up my life if need be, give up my honour, give up my dreams, but I will find her."
Beyond the battleground the road ran beside the shore, between the surging grey-green sea and the line of low limestone hills. Brian was not the only traveller on the road. There were fishing villages up along the coast for many leagues, and the fisherfolk used this road to take their fish to market. She rode past a fishwife and her daughters, walking home with empty baskets on their shoulders. In her armour, they took her for a knight until they saw her face. Then the girls whispered to one another and gave her looks.
"Have you seen a maid of 3 and 10 along the road?" she asked them. "A high-born maid with blue eyes and auburn hair."
Sir Shadrick had made her wary, but she had to keep on trying.
"She may have been travelling with a fool."
But they only shook their heads and giggled at her behind their hands. In the first village she came to, barefoot boys ran beside her horse. She had donned her helm, stung by the giggles of the fisherfolk, so they took her for a man. One boy offered to sell her clams, one offered crabs, and one offered her his sister. Brayne bought 3 crabs from the second boy, By the time she left the village, it had begun to rain, and the wind was rising.
"Storm coming," she thought, glancing out to sea.
The raindrops pinged against the steel of her helm, making her ears ring as she rowed. But it was better than being out there in a boat. An hour farther north, the road divided at a pile of tumbled stones that marked the ruins of a small castle. The right-hand fork followed the coast, meandering up along the shore toward Cratclaw Point, a dismal land of bugs and pine barrens. The left hand ran through hills and fields and woods to Maidenpool. The rain was falling more heavily by then. Brian dismounted and led her mare off the road to take shelter amongst the ruins. The course of the castle walls could still be discerned amongst the brambles, weeds, and wild elms, but the stones that had made them up were strewn like a child's blocks between the roads. Part of the main keep still stood, however. Its triple towers were grey granite, like the broken walls, but their merlons were yellow sandstone.
3 crowns, she realized, as she gazed at them through the rain. 3 golden crowns.
This had been a Hollard castle. Sir Dontus had been born here, like as not. She led her mare through the rubble to the keep's main entrance. Of the door only rusted iron hinges remained, but the roof was still sound, and it was dry within. Brian tied her mare to a wall sconce, took off her helm, and shook out her hair. She was searching for some dry wood to light a fire when she heard the sound of another horse coming closer. Some instinct made her step back into the shadows, where she could not be seen from the road. This was the very road where she and Sir Jamie had been captured. She did not intend to suffer that again. The rider was a small man.
A mad mouse, she thought, at her first sight of him. Somehow he's followed me.
Her hand went to her sword hilt, and she found herself wondering if Sir Shadrick would think her easy prey just because she was a woman. Lord Grandison's castellan had once made that error. Humphrey Wagstaff was his name, a proud old man of 65, with a nose like a hawk and a spotted head. The day they were betrothed, he warned Brian that he would expect her to be a proper lady once they'd wed.
"I will not have my lady wife cavorting about in man's mill. On this who shall abate me, lest I be forced to chastise you?"
She was 16, and no stranger to a sword, but still shy despite her prowess in the yard. Yet somehow she had found the courage to tell Sir Humphrey that she would accept chastisement only from a man who could outfight her. The old knight purpled, but agreed to don his armour to teach her a woman's proper place. They fought with blunted tawny weapons, so Brian's mace had no spikes. She broke Sir Humphrey's collarbone, 2 ribs, and their betrothal. He was her 3rd prospective husband, and her last. Her father did not insist again. If it was Sir Shadrick dogging her heels, she might well have a fight on her hands. She did not intend to partner with a man, or let him follow her to Sansa.
"He had the sort of easy arrogance that comes with skill at arms," she thought. "But he was small, and I'll have the reach on him, and I should be stronger, too."
Brian was as strong as most knights, and her old master-at-arms used to say that she was quicker than any woman her size had any right to be. The guards had given her stamina, too, which Sir Goodwin deemed a noble gift. Fighting with sword and shield was a wearisome business, and victory off went to the man with most endurance. Sir Goodwin had taught her to fight cautiously, to conserve her strength, while letting her foes spend theirs in furious attacks.
"Men will always underestimate you," he said, "and their pride will make them want to vanquish you quickly, lest it be said that a woman tried them sorely."
She had learned the truth of that once she went into the world. Even Jaime Lannister had come at her that way, in the woods by Maidenpool. If the guards were good, the mad mouse would make the same mistake.
"He may be a seasoned knight," she thought,
but he's no Jamie Lannister."
She slid her sword out of its scabbard. But it was not Shishadrick's chestnut courser that drew up where the road forked, but a broken-down old piebald Ronzi with a skinny boy upon his back. When Brian saw the horse, she drew back in confusion.
"Only some boy," she thought,
until she glimpsed the face beneath the hood.
"The boy in Duskendale. The one who bumped into me. It's him."
The boy never gave the ruined castle a glance, but looked down one road, then the other. After a moment's hesitation, he turned the Ramsay towards the hills and plodded on. Brian watched him vanish through the falling rain, and suddenly it came to her that she'd seen this boy in Rosby.
"He is talking me," she realized. "But that's a game two can play."
She untied her mare, climbed back into the saddle, and went after him. The boy was staring at the ground as he rode, watching the ruts in the road fill up with water. The rain muffled the sound of her approach, and no doubt his hood played a part as well. He never looked back once, until Brian trotted up behind him and gave the Ramsay a whack across the rump with the flat of her longsword. The horse reared, and the skinny boy went flying, his cloak flapping like a pair of wings. He landed in the mud and came up with dirt and dead brown grass between his teeth, to find Brian standing over him. It was the same boy, beyond a doubt. She recognized the sty.
"Who are you?"
she demanded. The boy's mouth worked soundlessly. His eyes were big as eggs.
"Puh!"
was all he could manage.
"Puh!"
His chainmail, Bernie, made a rattling sound when he shivered.
Puh! "Please?" said Brian. "Are you saying please?"
She laid the point of her sword on the apple of his throat.
"Please tell me who you are and why you're following me." "No, please!"
He stuck a finger in his mouth and flicked away a clump of mud, spitting.
My name, Podrick Payne."
Brian lowered her sword. She felt a rush of sympathy for the boy. She remembered a day at evenfall and a young knight with a rose in his hand.
"He brought a rose to give to me,"
or so her scepter told her. All she had to do was welcome him to her father's castle. He was 18, with long red hair that tumbled to his shoulders. She was 12, tight-laced into a stiff new gown, its bodice bright with garnets. The two of them were of a height, but she could not look him in the eye, nor say the simple words her scepter had taught her.
"Sir Runner, I welcome you to my lord father's hall. It is good to look upon your face at last."
"Why are you following me?" she demanded of the boy.
"Were you told to spy upon me? Do you belong to Varys or the queen?"
"No, not neither. No one."
Brian put his age at 10, but she was terrible at judging how old a child was. She always thought they were younger than they were, perhaps because she had always been big for her age.
"Freakish big,"
Scepter Roel used to say, and
"mannish. This road is too dangerous for a boy alone. Not for a squire. I mean squire, the hand squire.
Lord Tywin."
Brian sheathed her blade.
"No, not that hand, the one before, his son. I fought with him in the battle. I shouted, 'Half man, half man!'"
"The imp squire."
Brian had not even known he had one. Tyrion Lannister was no knight. He might have been expected to have a servant boy or two to attend him, she supposed, a page and a cupbearer, someone to help him dress, but a squire?
"Why are you stalking after me?" she said. "What do you want?"
"To find her."
The boy got to his feet.
"His lady. You're looking for her, Brella told me. She's his wife. Not Brella, Lady Sansa. So I thought, if you found her..."
His face twisted in sudden anguish.
"I'm his squire,"
he repeated, as the rain ran down his face.
"But he left me."
Sansa. Once, when she was just a little girl, a wandering singer had stayed with them at Winterfell for half a year. An old man he was, with white hair and wind-burnt cheeks. But he sang of knights and quests and ladies fair, and Sansa had cried bitter tears when he had left them, and begged her father not to let him go.
"The man has played us every song he knows, thrice over,"
Lord Eddard told her gently.
"I cannot keep him here against his will. You need not weep, though. I promise you other singers will come."
They hadn't, though. Not for a year or more. Sansa had prayed to the seven in their sept and old guards of the Heart Tree, asking them to bring the old man back, or better still, to send another singer, young and handsome. But the guards never answered, and the halls of Winterfell stayed silent. But that was when she was a girl and foolish. She was a maiden now, 3 and 10, and flowered. All her nights were full of song, and by day she prayed for silence. If the area had been made like other castles, only rats and jailers would have heard the dead man singing. Dungeon walls were thick enough to swallow songs and screams alike. But the sky cells had a wall of empty air, so every chord the dead man played flew free to echo off the stony shoulders of the giant's lance. And the songs he chose. He sang of the Dance of the Dragons, a fair jonquil and her fool, of Jenny of Oldstones, and the Prince of Dragonflies. He sang of betrayals and murders most foul, of hanged men and bloody vengeance. He sang of grief and sadness. No matter where she went in the castle, Sansa could not escape the music. It floated up the winding tower steps, found her naked in her bath, supped with her at dusk, and stole into her bedchamber even when she latched the shutters tight. It came in on the cold, thin air, and like the air, it chilled her. Though it had not snowed upon the area since the day that Lady Lysa fell, the nights had all been bitter cold. The singer's voice was strong and sweet. Sansa thought he sounded better than he ever had before, his voice richer somehow, full of pain and fear and longing. She did not understand why the guards would have given such a voice to such a wicked man. "He would have taken me by force on the fingers if Peter had not set Sir Lothar to watch over me," she had to remind herself. "And he played to drown out my cries when Aunt Lysa tried to kill me." That did not make the songs any easier to hear. "Please," she begged Lord Peter, "can't you make him stop?"
"I gave the man my word, sweetly."
Peter Baelish, Lord of Harrenhal, Lord Paramount of the Trident, and Lord Protector of the Eyrie and the Vale of Erin, looked up from the letter he was writing. He had written 100 letters since Lady Lysa's fall. Sansa had seen the ravens coming and going from the rookery.
"I'd sooner suffer his singing than listen to his sobbing."
"It is better that he sings, yes, but must he play all night, my lord? Lord Robert cannot sleep. He cries."
"For his mother."
"That cannot be helped. The wench is dead." Peter shrugged. "It will not be much longer. Lord Nestor is making his ascent on the morrow." Sansa had met Lord Nestor Royce once before, after Peter's wedding to her aunt. Royce was the keeper of the Gates of the Moon, the great castle that stood at the base of the mountain and guarded the steps up to the Eyrie. The wedding party had guested with him overnight before beginning their ascent. Lord Nestor had scarce looked at her twice, but the prospect of him coming here terrified her. He was High Steward of the Vale as well, John Arryn's trusted liegeman and Lady Lysa's.
"You won't let Lord Nestor see Marillion, will you?"
Her horror must have shown on her face since Peter put down his quill.
"On the contrary, I shall insist on it."
He beckoned her to take the seat beside him.
"We have come to an agreement, Marillion and I. Maud can be most persuasive. And if our singer disappoints us,
and sings a song we do not care to hear, why, you and I need only say he lies. Whom do you imagine Lord Nestor will believe? Us? Sansa wished she could be certain. Of course, our lies will profit him. The solar was warm, the fire crackling merrily, but Sansa shivered all the same.
Yes, but what if...
What if Lord Nestor values honour more than profit? Peter put his arm around her. What if it is truth he wants, and justice for his murdered lady? He smiled. I know, Lord Nestor, sweetling, do you imagine I'd ever let him harm my daughter?
I am not your daughter, she thought. I am Sansa Stark, Lord Ennard's daughter, and Lady Caitlin's, the blood of Winterfell.
She did not say it, though. If not for Peter Baelish, it would have been Sansa who went spinning through a cold blue sky to stony death 600 feet below instead of Lysa Arryn.
He is so bold.
Sansa wished she had his courage. She wanted to crawl back into bed and hide beneath her blanket, to sleep and sleep. She had not slept a whole night through since Lysa Arryn's death.
Couldn't you tell Lord Nestor that I am indisposed, or...
He will want to hear your account of Lysa's death.
My lord, if Marillion tells what truly...
If he lies, you mean?
Lies? Yes, if he lies, if it is my tale against his, and Lord Nestor looks in my eyes and sees how scared I am.
A touch of fear will not be out of place, Elaine. You've seen a fearful thing. Nestor will be moved. Peter studied her eyes, as if seeing them for the first time. You have your mother's eyes, honest eyes, and innocent, blue as a sunlit sea. When you are a little older, many a man will drown in those eyes. Sansa did not know what to say to that. All you need do is tell Lord Nestor the same tale that you told Lord Robert, Peter went on.
Robert is only a sick little boy, she thought. Lord Nestor is a man grown stern and suspicious.
Robert was not strong and had to be protected, even from the truth.
Some lies are love, Peter had assured her.
She reminded him of that.
When we lied to Lord Robert, that was just to spare him, she said.
And this lie may spare us, else you and I must leave the area by the same door Lysa used. Peter picked up his quill again. We shall serve him lies and arbor gold, and he'll drink them down and ask for more, I promise you.
He's serving me lies as well, Sansa realized. They were comforting lies, though, and she thought them kindly meant. A lie is not so bad if it is kindly meant.
If only she believed them. The things her aunt had said just before she fell still troubled Sansa greatly. Ravings, Peter called them. My wife was mad, you saw that for yourself.
And so she had. All I did was build a snow castle, and she meant to push me out of the moon door. Peter saved me. He loved my mother well, and...
And her? How could she doubt it? He had saved her.
He saved Elaine, his daughter, a voice within her whispered.
But she was Sansa, too, and sometimes it seemed to her that the Lord Protector was two people as well. He was Peter, her protector, warm and funny and gentle, but he was also Littlefinger, the lord she'd known at King's Landing, smiling slyly and stroking his beard as he whispered in Queen Cersei's ear. And Littlefinger was no friend of hers. When Joff had her beaten, the imp defended her, not Littlefinger. When the mob sought to rape her, the hound carried her to safety, not Littlefinger. When the Lannisters wed her to Tyrion against her will, Sir Garlan the Gallant gave her comfort, not Littlefinger. Littlefinger never lifted so much as his little finger for her.
Except to get me out. He did that for me. I thought it was Sir Dantus, my poor old drunken Florian. But it was Peter all the while. Littlefinger was only a mask he had to wear.
Only sometimes Sansa found it hard to tell where the man ended and the mask began. Littlefinger and Lord Peter looked so very much alike. She would have fled them both, perhaps, but there was nowhere for her to go. Winterfell was burned and desolate. Bran and Rickon dead and cold. Rob had been betrayed and murdered at the Twins, along with their lady mother. Tyrion had been put to death for killing Joffrey, and if she ever returned to King's Landing, the Queen would have her head as well. The aunt she hoped would keep her safe had tried to murder her instead. Her uncle Edmure was a captive of the Freys, while her great-uncle, the Blackfish, was under siege at Riveron. "I have no place but here," Sansa thought miserably, "and no true friend but Peter." That night the dead man sang, "The day they hang Black Robin, the mother's tears, and the rains of Castamere." Then he stopped for a while. But just as Sansa began to drift off, he started to play again. He sang Six Sorrows, Fallen Leaves, and Alysanne. Such sad song, she thought. When she closed her eyes, she could see him in his cell, huddled in a corner, away from the cold black sky, crouched beneath a fir, with his wood harp cradled against his chest. "I must not pity him," she told herself. "He was vain and cruel, and soon he will be dead." She could not save him, and why should she want to? Marillion tried to rape her, and Peter had saved her life not once but twice. Some lies you have to tell. Lies had been all that kept her alive in King's Landing. If she had not lied to Joffrey, his King's Guard would have beat her bloody. After Alysanne, the singer stopped again long enough for Sansa to snatch an hour's rest. But as the first light of dawn was prying at her shutters, she heard the soft strains of On a Misty Morn, drifting up from below, and woke at once. That was more properly a woman's song, a lament, sung by a mother on the dawn after some terrible battle, as she searches among the dead for the body of her only son. The mother sings her grief for her dead son, Sansa thought. But Marillion grieves for his fingers, for his eyes. The words rose like arrows, and pierced her in the darkness. "Oh, have you seen my boy, good sir? His hair is chestnut brown. He promised he'd come back to me. Our home's in Wendish Town." Sansa covered her ears with a goose-down pillow to shut out the rest of it. But it was no good. Day had come and she had woken, and Lord Nesta Royce was coming up the mountain. The High Steward and his party reached the Eyrie in the late afternoon, with the valley gold and red beneath them and the wind rising. He brought his son, Sir Albar, along with a dozen knights and a score of men-at-arms. So many strangers! Sansa looked at their faces anxiously, wondering if they were friends or foes. Peter welcomed his visitors in a black velvet doublet with grey sleeves that matched his woolen breeches and lent a certain darkness to his grey-green eyes. Maester Coleman stood beside him, his chain of many metals hanging loose about his long, skinny neck. Although the maester was much the taller of the two men, it was the Lord Protector who drew the eye. He had put away his smiles for the day, it seemed. He listened solemnly as Royce introduced the knights who had accompanied him, then said, "My lords are welcome here. You know our Maester Coleman, of course. Lord Nesta, you will recall Elaine, my natural daughter." "To be sure." Lord Nesta Royce was a bull-necked, barrel-chested, balding man with a grey-shot beard and a stern look. He inclined his head a whole half-inch in greeting. Sansa curtsied, too frightened to speak for fear she might misspeak. Peter drew her to her feet. "Sweetling, be a good girl, and bring Lord Robert to the High Hall to receive his guests." "Yes, father." Her voice sounded thin and strained. A liar's voice, she thought, as she hurried up the steps and across the gallery to the moon tower. A guilty voice. Gretchel and Mary were helping Robert Aaron squirm into his breeches when Sansa stepped into his bedchamber. The Lord of the Eyrie had been crying again. His eyes were red and raw, his lashes crusty, his nose swollen and runny. A trail of snot glistened underneath one nostril, and his lower lip was bloody where he'd bitten it. Lord Nestor must not see him like this, Sansa thought, despairing. Gretchel, fetch me the wash-basin. She took the boy by the hand and drew him to the bed. Did my sweet Robin sleep well last night?
No,
he sniffed.
I never slept one bit alone. He was singing again, and my door was locked. I called for them to let me out, but no one ever came. Someone locked me in my room.
Now, that was wicked of them. Dipping a soft cloth into the warm water, she began to clean his face. Gently, oh so gently. If you scrub Robert too briskly, he might begin to shake. The boy was frail and terribly small for his age. He was 8, but Sansa had known bigger 5-year-olds. Robert's lip quivered.
I was going to come sleep with you.
I know you were. Sweet Robin had been accustomed to crawling in beside his mother until she wed Lord Peter. Since Lady Lysa's death, he had taken to wandering the area in quest of other beds. The one he liked best was Sansa's, which was why she had asked Sir Lothar Brune to lock his door last night. She would not have minded if he only slept, but he was always trying to nuzzle at her breasts, and when he had his shaking spells, he often wet the bed. "Lord Ernesto Royce has come up from the gates to see you," Sansa wiped beneath his nose.
"I don't want to see him," he said. "I want a story of the Winged Knight."
"After," Sansa said, "first you must see Lord Nestor."
"Lord Nestor has a mole," he said, squirming.
Robert was afraid of men with moles.
"Mummy said he was dreadful."
"Oh, my poor sweet Robin," Sansa smoothed his hair back. "You miss her, I know. Lord Peter misses her too. He loved her just as you do." That was a lie, though kindly meant. The only woman Peter ever loved was Sansa's murdered mother. He had confessed as much to Lady Lysa just before he pushed her out of the moon door. "She was mad and dangerous. She murdered her own lord husband, and would have murdered me if Peter had not come along to save me." Robert did not need to know that, though. He was only a sick little boy who loved his mother. "There," Sansa said, "you look a proper lord now. Maddie, fetch his cloak." It was lamb's wool, soft and warm, a handsome sky blue that set off the cream colour of his tunic. She fastened it about his shoulders with a silver brooch in the shape of a crescent moon, and took him by the hand. Robert came meekly for once. The high hall had been closed since Lady Lysa's fall, and it gave Sansa a chill to enter it again. The hall was long and grand and beautiful, she supposed, but she did not like it here. It was a pale, cold place at the best of times. The slender pillars looked like finger bones, and the blue veins in the white marble brought to mind the veins in an old crone's legs. Though 50 silver sconces lined the walls, less than a dozen torches had been lit, so shadows danced upon the floors and pooled in every corner. Their footsteps echoed off the marble, and Sansa could hear the wind rattling at the moon door. "I must not look at it," she told herself, "else I'll start to shake as badly as Robert." With Mary's help, she got Robert seated on his weirwood throne, with a stack of pillows underneath him, and sent word that his lordship would receive his guests. Two guards in sky-blue cloaks opened the doors at the lower end of the hall, and Peter ushered them in and down the long blue carpet that ran between the rows of bone-white pillars. The boy greeted Lord Nestor with squeaky courtesy and made no mention of his mole. When the High Steward asked about his lady mother, Robert's hands began to tremble ever so slightly.
"Marillion hurt my mother. He threw her out of the moon door."
"Did your lordship see this happen?" asked Sir Marwyn Belmore, a lanky, ginger-headed knight who had been Lysa's captain of guards till Peter had put Sir Lothar Brune in his place.
"Elaine saw it," the boy said.
and my lord's stepfather.
Lord Nestor looked at her. Sir Albar, Sir Marwyn, Maester Coleman, all of them were looking.
She was my aunt, but she wanted to kill me, Sansa thought. She dragged me to the moon door and tried to push me out. I never wanted a kiss. I was building a castle in the snow.
She hugged herself to keep from shaking. Forgive her, my lords, Peter Baelish said softly. She still has nightmares of that day. Small wonder if she cannot bear her to speak of it. He came up behind her and put his hands gently on her shoulders. I know how hard this is for you, Aileen, but our friends must hear the truth.
Yes.
Her throat felt so dry and tight it almost hurt to speak.
I was with the lady, Lysa, when...
A tear rolled down her cheek. Oh, that's good. A tear is good.
When Marillion pushed her,
and she told the tale again, hardly hearing the words as they spilled out of her. Before she was half done, Robert began to cry, the pillows shifting perilously beneath him.
He killed my mother. I want him to fly.
The trembling in his hands had grown worse, and his arms were shaking too. The boy's head jerked, and his teeth began to chatter.
Fly!
He shrieked,
fly! Fly!
His arms and legs flailed wildly. Lothar Brune strode to the dais in time to catch the boy as he slipped from his throne. Maester Coleman was just a step behind, though there was naught that he could do. Helpless as the rest, Sansa could only stand and watch as a shaking spell ran its course. One of Robert's legs kicked Sir Lothar in the face. Brune cursed, but still held on as the boy twitched and flailed and wet himself. Their visitors said not a word. Lord Nestor, at least, had seen these fits before. It was long moments before Robert's spasms began to subside, and seemed even longer. By the end, the little lordling was so weak he could not stand.
"Best take his lordship back to bed and bleed him," Lord Peter said.
Brune lifted the boy in his arms and carried him from the hall. Maester Coleman followed, grim-faced. When their footsteps died away, there was no sound in the high hall of the Eyrie. Sansa could hear the night wind moaning outside and scratching at the moon door. She was very cold and very tired. Must I tell the tale again? She wondered. But she must have told it well enough. Lord Nestor cleared his throat.
I misliked that singer from the first, he grumbled. I urged Lady Lysa to send him away. Many a time I urged her.
You always gave her good counsel, my lord,
Peter said.
Well, she took no heed of it, Royce complained. She heard me grudgingly, and took no heed.
My lady was too trusting for this world. Peter spoke so tenderly that Sansa would have believed he loved his wife. Lysa could not see the evil in me, and only the good. Marillion sang sweet songs, and she mistook that for his nature.
He called us pigs,
Sir Arbar Royce said, a blunt, broad-shouldered knight who shaved his chin but cultivated thick black side whiskers that framed his homely face like hedgerows. Sir Arbar was a younger version of his father. He made a song about two pigs snuffling around a mountain, eating a falcon's leavings.
That was meant to be us. But when I said so, he laughed at me.
Why, sir, 'tis a song about some pigs, he said.
He made muck of me as well,
Sir Marwyn Belmore said. Sir Ding-Dong, he named me. When I vowed I'd cut his tongue out, he ran to Lady Lysa and hid behind her skirts.
As oft he did, Lord Nestor said. The man was craven, but the favour Lady Lysa showed him made him insolent. And she dressed him like a lord, gave him gold rings and a moonstone belt.
Even Lord John's favourite falcon.
The knight's doublet showed the six white candles of Waxley.
His lordship loved that bird. King Robert gave it to him.
Peter Baelish sighed.
It was unseemly, he agreed, and I put an end to it. Lysa agreed to send him away. That was why she met him here that day.
I should have been with her, but I never dreamt if I had not insisted. It was I who killed her. No, Sansa thought. You mustn't say that. You mustn't tell them. You mustn't. But Alba Royce was shaking his head. No, my lord, you must not blame yourself, he said. This was the singer's work, his father agreed. Bring him up, Lord Peter. Let us write an end to this sorry business. Peter Baelish composed himself and said, As you wish, my lord. He turned to his guardsmen and spoke a command, and the singer was fetched up from the dungeons. The jailer, Maud, came with him, a monstrous man with small black eyes and a lopsided, scarred face. One ear and part of his cheek had been cleaved off in some battle, but 20 stone of pallid white flesh remained. His clothes fit poorly, and had a rank, ripe smell. Marillion, by contrast, looked almost elegant. Someone had bathed him and dressed him in a pair of sky-blue breeches and a loose-fitting white tunic with puff sleeves, belted with a silvery sash that had been a gift from Lady Lysa. White silk gloves covered his hands, while a white silk bandage spared the lords the sight of his eyes. Maud stood behind him with a lash. When the jailer prodded him in the ribs, the singer went to one knee.
Good lords, I beg your forgiveness.
Lord Nestor scowled. You confess your crime?
If I had eyes, I should weep.
The singer's voice, so strong and sure by night, was cracked and whispery now.
I loved her so, I could not bear to see her in another's arms, to know she shared his bed. I meant no harm to my sweet lady, I swear it. I barred the door so no one could disturb us whilst I declared my passion. But Lady Lyser was so cold when she told me that she was carrying Lord Peter's child. A madness seized me.
Sancha stared at his hands while he spoke. Fat Maddie claimed that Maud had taken off 3 of his fingers, both pinkies and a ring finger. His little fingers did appear somewhat stiffer than the others, but with those gloves it was hard to be certain. It might have been no more than a story. How would Maddie know?
Lord Peter has been kind enough to let me keep my harp,
the blind singer said.
My harp and my tongue, so I may sing my songs. Lady Lysa dearly loved my singing.
Take this creature away, or I'd like to kill him myself, Lord Nestor growled. It sickens me to look at him. Mort, take him back to his sky cell, said Peter. Yes, my lord. Mort grabbed Marillion roughly by the collar. No more mouth. When he spoke, Sansa saw to her astonishment that the jailer's teeth were made of gold. They watched as he half-dragged, half-shoved the singer toward the doors. The man must die, Sir Marwyn Belmore declared when they were gone. He should have followed Lady Lysa out the moon door without his tongue, Sir Albar Royce added. Without that lying, mucking tongue. I have been too gentle with him, I know, Peter Baelish said in an apologetic tone. If truth be told, I pity him. He killed for love. For love or hate, said Belmore, he must die. Soon enough, Lord Nestor said gruffly. No man lingers long in the sky cells. The blue will call to him. It may, said Peter Baelish, but whether Marillion will answer, only he can say. He gestured, and his guardsmen opened the doors at the far end of the hall. Sirs, I know you must be weary after your ascent. Rooms have been prepared for all of you to spend the night, and food and wine awaits you in the lower hall. Oswell, show them the way, and see that they have all they need. He turned to Nestor Royce. My lord, will you join me in the solar for a cup of wine? Elaine, Sweetling, come pour for us. A low fire burned in the solar, where a flagon of wine awaited them, Arbor Gold. Sansa filled Lord Nestor's cup, whilst Peter prodded at the lugs with an iron poker. Lord Nestor seated himself beside the fire. This will not be the end of it, he said to Peter, as if Sansa were not there. My cousin means to question the singer himself.
Bronze Yon mistrusts me. Peter pushed a log aside. He means to come in force. Simon Templeton will join him. Do not doubt it. And Lady Wainwood, too, I fear. And Lord Belmore, young Lord Hunter, Horton Redfort, they will bring strong Samstone, the Tullets, the Shetts, the Coldwaters, some Corbrays. You are well informed. Which Corbrays, not Lord Lionel? No, his brother. Sir Lynn mislikes me for some reason. Lynn Corbray is a dangerous man, Lord Leicester said doggedly. What do you intend to do? What can I do but make them welcome if they come? Peter gave the flames another stir and set the poker down. My cousin means to remove you as Lord Protector. If so, I cannot stop him. I keep a garrison of 20 men. Lord Royce and his friends can raise 20,000. Peter went to the oaken chest that sat beneath the window. Bronze Yon will do what he will, he said, kneeling. He opened the chest, drew out a roll of parchment, and brought it to Lord Nestor. My lords, this is a token of the love my lady bore you. Sansa watched Royce unroll the parchment.
This is unexpected, my lord.
She was startled to see tears in his eyes. Unexpected, but not undeserved. My lady values you above all her other bannermen. You were her rock, she told me.
Her rock?
Lord Nestor reddened.
She said that?
Often. And this, Peter gestured at the parchment, is the proof of it.
That is good to know. John Aaron valued my service, I know, but Lady Lysa, she scorned me when I came to court her, and I feared...
Lord Nestor furrowed his brow.
It bears the Aaron seal, I see, but the signature...
Lysa was murdered before the document could be presented for her signature, so I signed as Lord Protector. I knew that would have been her wish.
I see.
Lord Nestor rolled the parchment.
You are dutiful, my lord, I, and not without courage. Some will call this grant unseemly, and fault you for making it. The keeper's post has never been hereditary. The Aarons raised the gates in the days when they were still the Falcon Crown and ruled the Vale as kings. The Aerie was their summer seat, but when the snows began to fall, the court would make its descent. Some would say the gates were as royal as the Aerie.
There has been no king in the Vale for 300 years, Peter Baelish pointed out.
The dragons came, Lord Nestor agreed, but even after the gates remained an Aaron castle. John Aaron himself was keeper of the gates, whilst his father lived. After his ascent, he named his brother, Ronald, to the honour, and later his cousin, Dennis.
Lord Robert has no brothers and only distant cousins.
True.
Lord Nestor clutched the parchment tightly.
I will not say I had not hoped for this. Whilst Lord John ruled the realm as hand, it fell to me to rule the Vale for him. I did all that he required of me, and asked nothing for myself. But by the gods I earned this.
You did, said Peter. And Lord Robert sleeps more easily, knowing that you are always there, a staunch friend at the foot of his mountain. He raised a cup.
So, a toast, my lord. To House Royce, Keeper of the Gates of the Moon, now and forever.
Now and forever, aye.
The silver cups crashed together. Later, much later, after the flagon of Arbor Gold was dry, Lord Nestor took his leave to rejoin his company of knights. Sansa was asleep on her feet by then, wanting only to crawl off to her bed, but Peter caught her by the wrist.
You see the wonder that can be worked with lies and Arbor Gold.
Why did she feel like weeping? It was good that Nestor Royce was with them.
Were they all lies?
Not all. Lysa often called Lord Nestor a rock, though I do not think she meant it as a compliment. She called his son a clod. She knew Lord Nestor dreamed of holding the gates in his own right. A lord in truth as well as name,
but Lysa dreamed of other sons and meant the castle to go to Robert's little brother. He stood. "Do you understand what happened here, Elaine?" Sansa hesitated a moment.
"You gave Lord Nestor the Gates of the Moon to be certain of his support."
"I did," Peter admitted. "But Arok is a Royce, which is to say he is overproud and prickly. Had I asked him his price, he would have swelled up like an angry toad at the slight upon his honour. But this way, the man is not utterly stupid, but the lies I served him were sweeter than the truth. He wants to believe that Lysa valued him above her other bannerman. One of those others is Bronze Yon, after all, and Nestor is very much aware that he was born of the lesser branch of House Royce. He wants more for his son. Men of honour will do things for their children that they would never consider doing for themselves." She nodded.
"The signature, you might have had Lord Robert put his hand and seal to it, but instead—"
"I signed myself as Lord Protector."
"Why?"
"So if you are removed or killed, Lord Nestor's claim on the gates will suddenly be called into question. I promise you that is not lost on him. It was clever of you to see it, though no more than I'd expect of mine own daughter."
"Thank you." She felt absurdly proud for puzzling it out, but confused as well. "I'm not, though, your daughter. Not truly, I mean. I pretend to be Elaine, but, you know—"
Littlefinger put a finger to her lips.
"I know what I know, and so do you. Some things are best left unsaid, sweetling. Even when we are alone, especially when we are alone. Elsewise, a day will come when a servant walks into a room unannounced, or a guardsman at the door chances to hear something he should not. Do you want more blood on your pretty little hands, my darling?"
Marillion's face seemed to float before her, the bandage pale across his eyes. Behind him, she could see Sedontus, the crossbow bolts still in him.
"No," Sansa said. "Please."
"I am tempted to say this is no game we play, daughter. But of course it is. The Game of Thrones."
"I never asked to play."
The game was too dangerous.
"One slip and I'm dead. Oswald, my lord, Oswald, rode me from King's Landing the night that I escaped. He must know who I am."
"If he's half as clever as a sheep's pellet, you would think so. Sir Lothar knows as well, but Oswald has been in my service a long time, and Brune is close-mouthed by nature. Kettle Black watches Brune for me, and Brune watches Kettle Black. Trust no one," I once told Eddard Stark, but he would not listen. "You are Elaine, and you must be Elaine all the time." He put two fingers on her left breast. "Even here, in your heart. Can you do that? Can you be my daughter in your heart?"
I do not know, my lord," she almost said, but that was not what he wanted to hear. "Lies and are begold," she thought. "I'm Elaine, father. Who else would I be?"
Lord Littlefinger kissed her cheek.
"With my wits and cat's beauty, the world will be yours, sweetling. Now, off to bed."
Gretchel had laid a fire in her hearth and plumped her feather bed. Sansa undressed and slipped beneath the blankets.
"He will not sing tonight," she prayed. "Not with Lord Nestor and the others in the castle. He would not dare."
She closed her eyes. Sometime during the night she woke, as little Robert climbed up into her bed.
"I forgot to tell Lothar to lock him in again," she realized.
There was nothing to be done for it, so she put her arm around him. "Sweet Robin, you can stay, but try not to squirm around. Just close your eyes and sleep, little one."
"I will."
He cuddled close and laid his head between her breasts.
"Elaine, are you my mother now?"
"I suppose I am," she said.
if a lie was kindly meant, there was no harm in it. The Kraken's daughter.